This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, welcome to The World Today. I'm Samantha Donovan. This Friday, the International Criminal Court to investigate alleged crimes against Rohingya Muslims by the government of Myanmar. And why is a Chinese company paying well over $1 billion for an Australian infant formula company? But first, many Australians are again bracing for tough fire conditions today. About 60 blazes are still burning in Queensland, and more than 50 are still a concern in New South Wales. And the political pressure is building on the federal government. Today, a group of local councils is calling on it to acknowledge that climate change is a factor in these fires and also to boost firefighting resources. David Sparks reports.
The fires threatened Sydney's outskirts this week, where for the first time the danger was rated as catastrophic. Parts of South Tarramurra on the city's upper north shore were hit, and residents there say they're nervous about the summer ahead.
I do get a little bit nervous because we were here in 94 when we had the huge fires and they came right up to our lawn. So every summer we get a little bit nervous, and this summer, of course, it's even fiercer, isn't it?
I'm only worried because the neighbour went for a walk through there yesterday and told my husband that a lot of it wasn't burnt. So I almost felt better thinking that the undergrowth and everything had burnt out because I thought we won't be at risk the rest of the summer. So now, yeah, a bit nervous.
More than 250 homes have been destroyed in northern New South Wales, and Ben Shepherd from the Rural Fire Service says crews are anticipating tough conditions again.
It's this reintroduction once again of these very gusty west to northwesterly winds. So we're expecting averaging probably around 20 to 30, but gusting up as high, possibly up to 70 kilometres an hour over the Blue Mountains. So, look, that's driving up the fire danger once again.
Queensland's Fire and Emergency Service is also expecting more flare-ups. The fire warning has been upgraded to severe today for the Darling Downs and the Granite Belt, and it remains at very high for southeast Queensland. While exhausted fire crews continue their work, critics continue to attack the federal government. They wanted to acknowledge the link between extreme weather events and climate change.
It's about time governments stop trying to shut down the debate on what is a driving factor behind the phenomenon we're experiencing.
Mark Greenhill is mayor of the Blue Mountains Council.
Unprecedented weather conditions, summer after summer after summer, in recent times has broken records. And we need to understand that climate change is a factor in these fires. Support the views of the former fire chiefs. Government needs to be open to this debate.
He's one of the mayors and deputy mayors from 11 councils that have released a joint letter today calling on the government to reduce emissions. They also want an increase in funding for frontline services to tackle an increasing number of disasters.
More immediately, we're calling for the proper resourcing of emergency services efforts to cater for summers that will be much longer, fire seasons that will go for a far greater period of time, and fires that will be more widespread and more intense. This means that there needs to be direct funding of greater resources to combat these immediate effects of climate change.
The group says this week's fires have been, at least in part, fuelled by climate change. They point to evidence that 13 of the hottest 14 years on record have occurred this century. Claire Ponton is Deputy Mayor of the Mid-Coast Council in New South Wales.
Well, certainly the fires around here are due to the very deep drought that we've been in. This area has traditionally been a dairy area and very green. There's patches of littoral rainforest. And over the last 15, 20 years or more, people are telling me that it's just been drying out and we're in a very bad drought here at the moment. It's certainly a symptom of climate change.
How do you feel when you hear members of the state and federal governments talking about this as a topic which is discussed by inner city green lefties?
Yeah, there's none of those up here. Obviously, we're regional. And we're hearing the biggest concerns from our farming community. They are struggling.
The Emergency Services Minister, David Littleproud, has agreed to meet a group of former emergency services chiefs, which has also voiced its frustration about climate change and what it sees as a failure to properly prepare for this year's fire season.
David Sparks reporting. The AFP is calling for eyewitnesses to come forward after an international probe into the downing of Malaysian Airlines flight MH17 found Ukraine rebels were in close contact with Russian officials before the attack. Records of phone calls made before the 2014 disaster have now been released by those investigators. Russia is dismissing the new evidence, again insisting it had nothing to do with the attack. Gavin Coote prepared this report.
It's this phone call that investigators believe shed more light on Russia's influence in the shooting down of MH17 over territory held by pro-Russia separatists in eastern Ukraine. The conversation is between a leader of the pro-Russian rebels in the Donetsk People's Republic and an official in Moscow, and took place on the 1st of July 2014, 16 days before the downing of MH17, which killed all 298 passengers and crew, including 38 Australians. And with this, just one of a series of taped phone calls detailing almost daily contact with Russia, there's now a fresh appeal for eyewitnesses.
The JIT wants to know who controlled the rebel leadership in Donetsk and who commanded the deployment of the Buck-Taylor.
That's Andy Krag, the head of the Dutch Police Central Criminal Investigations Division and part of the MH17 Joint Investigation Team, or JIT. He's eager to get to the bottom of who ordered the deployment of the Russian-made missile believed to have destroyed the Boeing 777.
We showed that the armed group in Donetsk was in contact with Russian government officials about military support. Recent analysis of witness statements and other information revealed that Russian influence on the DPR went further than military support. Ties between Russian officials and DPR leaders appear to have been much closer.
In June, the team charged three Russians and one Ukrainian with 298 murders, who will be prosecuted by Dutch authorities in March next year. Now, another two people have been named. Sergei Askinov, the man that Moscow put in charge of Russian-annexed Crimea, and Vladislav Surkov, a senior aide to Russian President Vladimir Putin. The World Today requested an interview with the Australian Federal Police, which is also part of the investigation team. In a pre-recorded video, AFP Senior Investigations Officer David Nelson urged for any information about the leadership that ordered the attack and those who operated the missile system.
The JIT is looking for witnesses who could share information about those who controlled the rebel leadership in Donetsk and commanded the deployment of the Buk-Taylor. Of course, we are also still interested in more information about the identity of the crew of the Buk-Taylor.
Both the rebels and Moscow have repeatedly denied any involvement in the MH17 attack. And now, Maria Zakharova from Russia's foreign ministry has questioned the authenticity of the phone recordings.
What are the conclusions based on? The publication of evidence, some of which immediately turned out to be fake, and some of which doesn't check out. We've been through this already.
And she's accused the investigation team of bias.
The verdict, the sentence, was handed down immediately, and the rest is about adjusting evidence in accordance with what the group you mentioned considers being in favour of the prosecution tactics.
For the Australian Federal Police, it admits the last 5 years have been challenging, but insists it hasn't lost focus on the goal of seeking justice for family and friends rocked by the 2014 tragedy.
Gavin Coote reporting. In a landmark move, the International Criminal Court is opening an investigation into the alleged forced deportation of hundreds of thousands of Rohingya Muslims to Bangladesh and whether crimes against humanity were committed. UN investigators say a campaign of mass violence carried out by Myanmar's army in 2017 was so widespread and brutal that it was organised at the highest level of government. Sarah Dingle has recently come back from the world's biggest refugee camp, Cox's Bazar, in Bangladesh, where many Rohingya now live. A short time ago, I asked her about the significance of the ICC's announcement.
Well, this is big news, Sam. After 2 years, or more than 2 years, of the Rohingya being in limbo in Bangladesh, the International Criminal Court says it will investigate whether they were forcibly deported from Myanmar and whether in the event of that happening, there were any crimes against humanity, such as the persecution of the Rohingya. Now, this has come about through a rather creative means, I suppose you would say. The International Criminal Court actually doesn't have any jurisdiction over Myanmar. So what they're doing is they're bringing this investigation into the forced deportation of these people to Bangladesh, because Bangladesh has signed on to the International Criminal Court. It's been a pretty big week in accountability news. This follows two other moves, one by the Gambia, which brought a case in the International Court of Justice against Myanmar. And in Argentina, human rights groups have filed a lawsuit in a federal court naming Myanmar leader Aung San Suu Kyi and the commander-in-chief of the Myanmar military, naming them in this lawsuit for crimes against the Rohingya.
Now, you've just got back recently from a trip to the biggest refugee camp in the world, Cox's Bazar in Bangladesh. More than 600,000 Rohingya living there. Just what are the conditions like?
Well, this camp has exploded since the mass violence which forced these people to flee in August 2017. So there's been a mad scramble to suddenly create the services. You can imagine the biggest waste treatment facility ever constructed in a refugee settlement in the world is in this camp. There, all these people are crammed into just 13 square kilometres and they need water, food, shelter. As you can imagine, these people are also suffering intense trauma. Their villages were burned. Occasionally, people themselves were burned. They were attacked. They were injured. Many people were killed. And then they had to walk across the border into Bangladesh with basically nothing. And the nation hosting them, Bangladesh itself, is already a poor and extremely densely populated country.
How are the locals coping with that massive influx of people?
Tensions are rising between the Rohingya and the locals. And these flashpoints come, you know, in all shapes and sizes. It can be over something as everyday as the free LPG given to the Rohingya refugees by NGOs so that they can cook their food. Some Bangladeshis see that as an unbelievable luxury, and they can't believe that refugees are getting this stuff for free when they don't. On the other hand, local media, Bangladeshi media, is starting to report things like the Rohingya are involved in drug smuggling. There is a drug called Yaba, which is made in Myanmar. It's an extremely potent combination of methamphetamine and caffeine, and the fear is that the Rohingya refugees are bringing this into the country. So all of these things are coalescing. At the same time, more than half the people in the biggest refugee camp in Bangladesh, and in fact the world, are children, and they are not allowed to attend any state schools. They are not allowed to learn the local language, Bangla, because the government wants to keep them separate from the host population. And counter-terrorism police in Dhaka told me that they fear this is essentially a situation ripe for radicalisation. If in a few years' time the children who become teenagers in this camp realise they can never go home and they are segregated and they haven't had a proper education, the situation could explode.
So it's, as you say, sounding unlikely that they'll be able to return to Myanmar. Are there any signs, though, that that may be a chance?
Well, Myanmar says they can return and it is safe. Human rights groups strongly dispute that. The UN itself says any return of the Rohingya has to be voluntary, safe and sustainable. And so far, they do not see those conditions existing for return.
Our reporter, Sarah Dingle. And you can listen to Sarah's background briefing investigation into what's next for the Rohingya on the ABC Listen app now, or tune in to the broadcast on Sunday morning at 8:05 on Radio National. This is The World Today. One of Australia's biggest infant formula companies, Bellamy's, is set to be sold to a Chinese company. The prospective owner, China Mengniu, is partly owned by the Chinese government. The Federal Treasurer, Josh Frydenberg, has approved the sale, providing a number of conditions are met. Stephanie Boris has more.
It's a product used by families across Australia and highly sought after overseas.
Both of my beautiful kids, Violet and Dom, were brought up on Bellamy's, so I'm incredibly proud to call myself a Bellamy's mum.
Now, one of the nation's leading infant formula companies, Bellamy's Australia, is set to be sold.
This will see increased investment and jobs in Australia.
Treasurer Josh Frydenberg has approved the sale of Bellamy's Australia to China Mengniu. It's one of China's largest dairy manufacturers and is partly owned by the Chinese government. The Foreign Investment Review Board here in Australia determined the sale is not against the national interest.
By being purchased in this way, they will continue to see more investment in their business, in particular their milk processing and powder facilities, but also they will continue to export into the region.
But not everyone thinks the sale is a good idea. Jackie Lambie is an independent senator for Tasmania.
My biggest fear is, like the rest of Australia, is that we are being bought by the communist Chinese and we're being bought up as soon as they open their checkbooks. That is absolutely concerning to the future of the country when it comes to our food security and our national security.
Jackie Lambie says parents have struggled to buy product in the past and she's worried that may happen again.
I don't think this is a smart way forward. I don't feel this is good for our future of Australians, especially those newborns.
But Treasurer Josh Frydenberg doesn't agree.
I don't think those concerns are well-based.
But can you guarantee that infant formula will still be readily available for parents to buy following this sale?
We're absolutely confident that this will not affect the domestic market in this regard.
Jan Carey is the CEO of the Infant Nutrition Council and she's calling for calm.
There is plenty of formula on the shelves for Australian babies. If a consumer is looking for a particular brand, then there's always product available through the company's care lines and product is kept for them and can be delivered directly to the consumer.
In order for the sale to go ahead, China Mengniu must abide by certain conditions, such as ensuring the majority of Bellamy's board of directors are Australian resident citizens and keeping the company's headquarters in Australia for at least 10 years. They'll also be required to invest millions of dollars in infant milk formula processing facilities in Victoria.
I think it's very good for the Victorian community. It'll make sure that jobs are maintained. It's good to have business relationships between Chinese companies and Australian companies.
Josh Frydenberg says there will be consequences if the company doesn't follow through with the conditions.
If these obligations are not met from foreign investors, then there are strict penalties that apply. Ultimately, there is the option to also seek divestment, but that is, of course, a sanction of last resort.
In a statement, Bellamy's Australia says the sale remains subject to a number of conditions, including shareholders voting next month on the proposal and court approval.
Stephanie Boris. China has long been accused by human rights groups of harvesting organs from prisoners and selling them on a transplant black market. Now new research suggests the Chinese government may be systematically falsifying the records of voluntary organ donations. The study, led by the Australian National University, analysed official Chinese data and found the numbers reported by Beijing simply don't stack up. Victoria Pengilly has more.
Falun Gong is a spiritual practice which Chinese authorities consider subversive and contrary to communist ideals. Jennifer Zhang is a Falun Gong devotee who says she was arrested, detained and tortured in a Chinese detention camp in the early 2000s. During her detention, her blood was tested and her body scanned, but she says it was a throwaway comment which saved her from having her organs harvested.
On the first day, a doctor actually asked us about our medical history, and I honestly told him that I had hepatitis C before I practiced Falun Gong. I told him in order to show to him that Falun Gong has health benefit, but later on I realised what a narrow escape I had.
Earlier this year, an international tribunal claimed the organs of prisoners, both criminal and of conscience, are being illegally harvested and traded in China, something the communist country has repeatedly denied. Today, new research shows the Chinese government may have also been systematically falsifying the number of organs it claims it's voluntarily collected since 2010. Rather than reporting on actual donations, the study from the Australian National University claims the numbers aren't accurate. PhD candidate Matthew Robertson led the study. He used to work for the Epoch Times, a Chinese newspaper founded by the Falun Gong movement. But he claims the association hasn't influenced his work.
The Chinese authorities said they, you know, had reformed it in 2014. And now we have found that the numbers that they published that were supposed to show that they had reformed it have been basically made up.
According to Matthew Robertson, there were major anomalies with the data.
You know, you've got a surgeon, they said we did 500 transplants, but their own official Red Cross office that keeps track of the voluntary numbers said this province we only did 100, let's say. And so there is a big gap.
It's that gap that academics like Professor Wendy Rogers from Macquarie University say is likely to be filled with non-voluntary donors.
What that paper shows is that China is not at all transparent about how many organ donors there are, how many organs there are per donor, and how the organs, how many transplants are done. Their statistical analysis can't show where the organs come from. But the China Tribunal, which was headed up by Sir Geoffrey Nice and came to, after a year of investigation, came to a finding in June that prisoners of conscience have been murdered for their organs for many years in China.
Jennifer Zhang says she hopes the media attention will encourage other countries, including Australia, to speak up.
If this regime is doing this to its own innocent citizen, can we expect them to treat us well? Again, sadly, I think many countries, many governments in the world has not got the point yet.
Falun Gong practitioner Jennifer Zhang ending that report by Victoria Pengilly. And the World Today has put a number of questions to the Chinese embassy, but we haven't received a response. A gold mine of lost or unclaimed superannuation now exceeds almost $21 billion, according to fresh data out today from the Australian Taxation Office. Under new laws, the ATO is to reunite Australians with missing parts of their retirement nest eggs that have become dormant thanks to job changes, moving home, or simply changing an email address. The ABC's senior business correspondent Peter Ryan has been looking at the potential super bonanza and joins me now. Peter, this sounds like a lot of money. Could it be life-changing for some Australians?
Well, Sam, normally people might worry about getting a call from the ATO, especially given the risk of getting an audit, but this time it's potentially good news. Last year alone, more than $4.4 billion was recovered from around 540,000 super funds, which now have to report inactive accounts. So far, $1.2 billion has been paid back into super accounts, and $161 million directly into bank accounts. ATO Assistant Commissioner Graham White has been delivering some life-changing news for some Australians, and he told me that lost super has become a big problem for some pretty simple reasons.
Imagine you move house, you don't update the addresses. If you ever moved, changed your email address, well, that's like moving house. These sort of things where you do become disconnected from your super.
And until now, it's been difficult for people to keep track of what may be several superannuation accounts.
Now it's relatively easy, because you can just go onto our online services and you can see it there.
And this can add up to a lot of money for some people.
For example, one lady who is 68, we've been able to reunite her with $1.5 million. Just the other day, we were speaking to a person who, believe it or not, $119,000 landed in their bank account. They were over 65, so they could access their super, and they had just forgotten about it. And I think it was a very nice surprise for them at that time in their life.
We're in the midst of a pretty bad bushfire season at the moment that's probably going to be getting worse, but you've been able to reunite a woman with a lot of lost superannuation money, and she'd lost her house in recent bushfires.
Yes, it was. It was a sad case where someone had lost their house. We had been trying to find them for a while, as we do, but they had re-engaged with the ATO through their accountant, and we were able to tell them that they had $600,000 in unclaimed superannuation there. And because they were over 65, we were able to get it to them.
And what sort of occupations are at the most risk of not knowing how much superannuation they might have out there that's missing or lost?
If you're male, truck drivers aged between 31 and 60 years, residing in Queensland, Western Australia, New South Wales and Victoria, are more likely than any other male to have a multiple account. And when it comes to females, it's teachers, infant, primary and high school teachers residing in Queensland.
The ATO's Assistant Commissioner Graham White with the ABC's Peter Ryan. And that's The World Today for this week. The program's supervising producer is Michael Edwards. Associate producer is Barney Porter. Technical production by Kem White and Alan Arthur, and web publishing by Matthew Bates and Sandra Orr-Prince. Tomorrow morning, I'll bring you Saturday AM. I'm Samantha Donovan. Have a great weekend.
Hi, I'm Ruby Jones.
And I'm Chris Dengate, and we're from the ABC's daily news podcast, The Signal. Last weekend, a 19-year-old man was shot dead in the remote Northern Territory community of Uendamu.
A 28-year-old Northern Territory police officer has now been charged with murder. He's been bailed and suspended on full pay.
Today on The Signal, we look into the death of Kumanjai Walker.
Look for The Signal on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.